But in a neat way, it's helpful because you can pull off your cans and you can like get an idea of what's going on in the reality of it. Yeah, and after you get used to it, it's really neat.
Yeah,
it's, you know, it surprised me how neat it was. I thought I was never going to get used to it. But shit, man, it turned out to be a breeze. You know? And now, actually, I'd rather do it that way.
I'm sure. Get rid of any of this virus.
Strange engineers and stuff come in and they just go, ah! You know, and they see that. But shit, after a little while, they pick right up on it, you know? And, yeah, we did a couple, cranked out a couple there. Did that last one with Paul George. That was a good trip.
That's a great record. I enjoyed it.
We had a good time. He was a good guy, man. You know, that was too bad, you know. But we had a good time. Yeah. And, shit, I wrote a lot of songs with him and stuff like that. I'm doing a couple songs with this band I wrote. Yeah, like that. Yeah, it's real hard to get table space, but you can hang out on like that, sure, you know. Like, this place is real uptight for space.
I know.
Yeah, you know. So,
dude working there, staring around, hassle.
Yeah, hassle. Yeah, I know. You can come fucking hang out on stage with me as far as I'm concerned.
I'm just coming to know.
Yeah, you can get that. You
just earphones on.
Hey, come on.
That's it.
Right on.
Gaffer's
Yeah, right. Yeah, all you have to do is know a few key words, right? Gaffer's Day! Right.
Reasonably.
Roll it!
Yeah.
Well, what are you guys up to now? What's going on? Who are you?
We're from the University of Maryland.
Oh, okay.
Right after graduate.
Right.
We're just kind of, this is kind of like a hobby of ours, but we do is...
Are you in like the journalistic department or something?
Well,
like that,
we write stories. They have a paper there. You know. And if they like them, they take them. We interview the people.
So you guys are sort of freelancers.
Right? Yeah. But
neat. Right on.
We like to give them a little bit of a sound, the kind of music that we like to listen to. Everybody did the new wave over there, you know, and the power of spirit and everything. We presented to them, we've been following the band for a while. We talked to Art about the drink summer.
It's
quite fun, you know.
Sure, out of sight. It sounds like you guys got a good little scene going.
No, it's fun, you know. I like to know about what people do with music.
Far out.
You listen to it, you know. It's not all we do.
Thanks. Hey, Dan, I'll see you soon. I'll see you guys. Thank
you. Yeah, we've been having a real great time in this band. It's a good little band, you know, playing hot music. And it's a real good opportunity to, like, do something outside of the, well, I hate to call it a monolith, but the Grateful Dead has become such a, like, such a big thing that a lot of areas of music are hard to work on because there's so much responsibility on a gig. You know, you do a gig, there's 20,000 people there. Yeah, another term I hate to use is status quo. You have to deliver at least a certain kind of show, which kind of limits your ability to be able to like try a lot of new ideas and shit on stage. And you pretty much have to kind of like stick to. You can stretch out a little bit, but you can't stretch out a lot, you know, and stuff like that. And that coupled with the fact that there's tremendous crowds and stuff like that everywhere, it kind of like it limits a certain kind of style of playing, and that's the style of like a more laid back, kick back kind of a style, you know. And it's a part of music that everybody kind of needs to do, you know. And so this sort of provides, occupation of our time when we're not doing Grateful Dead. Like Jerry's got his band, and Ace's got his band, and I got this band, you know. And it sort of gives us an opportunity to go and play in a lower key situation and do things with sort of less gravity involved and shit, you know, where we can stretch out and try ideas. Like, we try songs and stuff, we do songs every night that we've never done before and stuff like that. Just, hey, let's try this, you know. And so it enables us to stretch out. And right now, myself, personally, I've been developing, like, new ways of producing records and stuff like that and developing new tones and textures and approaches for recording. So this offers me, like, an ideal opportunity to be able to try various different ideas and different combinations of arrangements and instruments and tones and stuff like that. And having, like, Mike Larscheid and Billy Kreisman and Richard Treese and Keith and all of that, who are all like great players, gives us a good opportunity to be able to try things, you know, and everybody's good enough players that everybody can pretty much handle themselves and cover their action and stuff like that. So you can spring something on them out of a clear blue sky and you can pick it up on it and stuff, you know. So in that respect, it's really great. It makes it a good trip, you know. It makes it really fun. Plus, it keeps us out of trouble. It gives us something to do. I mean, shit, the only thing you know is music. That's our whole life, you know. And if we're not doing it in the Grateful Dead, we're home sitting on our hands, you know. fuck, that's no good. So we finally got here a few years ago, like, we all just said, fuck it, let's do our own trip, you know, and that's when Jared started doing his thing, and Weird did his band, and we started doing this. I've been playing with Richard Treese for, like, about, oh shit, over 15 years. We were, like, in high school, and we started playing together. And then, right about that same time, I also met the Grateful Dead, like, about 1965. And I was at that time working in a recording studio in San Francisco a little. In those days, it was a three-track studio, but in those days, that was like the biggest trip going, you know. And so I lived on a houseboat in Sausalito, and my next-door neighbor was John Cipollina, who's the lead guitar player from Crystal River, Massachusetts.
Your next-door neighbor?
Yeah, and also my buddy, we went to high school with. And so what happened was, the Grateful Dead and the Christopher were playing at the old Fillmore one night. This is even before Bill Graham had it or any of that thing. That's when it was just a multi-purpose room, and anybody could go and rent it for $200 a night. So what we used to do is, like, we charged $2 at the door until we got our $200 and let everybody else in free, and we just had the place, you know. Eventually, after this went on for about a year, the Fillmore Corporation called us all. There was, like, by then there was maybe a half a dozen of us that would go and get this place on various weekends. Bill Graham at that time was like the manager of the meme troupe. So once in a while they'd get it, you know, and then we get it, we do our gigs there. And then the Fillmore Corporation finally offered us a 1-year lease on the place for $5,000. Well, we were all stone broke hippies, right? But Bill Graham had the bread, so he got the lease on the place. And then it turned into that whole trip. But prior to that, it was like a real loose kind of a trip. It was like this trip here, it was real loose. You know, and there weren't a lot of rules and regulations and stuff like that. So we just started, so I started doing that, and because I was working, so I went to this gig one night with Cipollina, who just conned me into going to the gig with him. And the Grateful Dead were playing there at the same time. And I walked in the dressing room, and I met Phil Lesh, and somehow we just clicked, you know.
Did you know any of the guys at all?
I didn't know any of them then. I knew Garcia a little bit, but I had only just sort of knew him casually, you know. And then I met all these guys this night, and it's just somehow chemically we clicked, you know. And so I started hanging out with them, and I had, because I was in this recording studio, the Grateful Dead had never recorded before. So what we used to do is we used to sneak in the studio at night. I'd wait like till after the owners split and everything, you know, and I'd pretend like I split. I had a key to the place, right? And then we'd wait till after dark, and then we'd like sneak back in the studio and sneak all the equipment in and set it up and record, you know. And so that's how my career with the Grateful Dead got started. And then like that, then finally we got a record contract, and then it got to be regular business and all that. So then we got into bigger studios and more equipment and stuff like that, and started making records. And at the same time, I was playing with Richard Treese in a band called The Bicycle out in San Francisco. And we did that band for a while. We made a record and did a bunch of stuff like that. But by then, like, I was doing a lot of engineering and producing. Yeah. By then, I was doing The Grateful Dead, and I was doing Quicksilver, and I was doing The Charlatans, and I was doing Doug Sir Doug, Doug Song. And so I just kept doing that, and one thing led to another, you know, I got farther and farther into producing records and stuff like that. And then the Grateful Dead, always being such a looser, more broad-minded, hipper trip, like, it offered me a place to be able to take my experiments further. So the Grateful Dead has always been phenomenally good about writing with you for trying new ideas and stuff like that. As you've seen over the years, when I'm building that sound system and stuff, those guys gave me the bread. They gave me and Housley a $1.5 million to build that fucking 74 sound system. Now, every one of those guys could have easily just taken their bread and bought Cadillacs and houses and ranches and all of that shit, but no, man, they gave us the bread.
When did you go ahead and try the first time? Do you remember?
Pardon me?
When was the first time you used the system? Do you remember?
Use what?
That you used the system.
We unveiled it. Well, it came in stages.
Is that?
No, that was within the first year we used it. It was still in its breadboard stages in those days. That was what, like 72, 73?
73.
Yeah. Right, okay, now that was like the first sort of like colossal setup that we did. And we had done a couple other ones like it, but that was unique in that. That was the first time we had ever done it in a proscenium type theater. So we erected a special scaffolding, which there's still pictures floating around, you can see, where the bottom part was flat out, but then the top part, we tilted it all the way back across the top so that it would go up to the balcony. And we spent like a week setting this thing up, and it was magnificent. It was truly far out, you know. And between that and making records, I just, you know, I was busy all the time. And when the Grateful Dead had downtime, I would do things like produce records for Quicksilver and Sir Doug. I've done all of Sir Doug's records. and like Mendocino and all of those. I produced all of those songs. And then like the Grateful Dead finally just got to be more and more time consuming, and pretty soon it was just like pretty soon I hung up. At that time I was signed to Mercury Records as a staff producer, and like I didn't dig that, so I scuffled around and got out from under that because I really wanted to be an independent, you know. So I because I wanted time, I didn't want to be tied down to one thing. And the thing is, like, if you sign on as a staff producer for a record company, then you sort of like have to take the bad with the good, you know. So you have to produce their shit groups along with their good groups and stuff like that. And I kind of didn't dig it because I didn't really, my goal really wasn't to just score this gig as a producer. I wanted to go farther and create music and design equipment and innovate new ideas for making music as well as just producing it and stuff. So I finally got out from under that, and then I did a year stint with Capitol as a producer. And then I had learned not to sign any more contracts with any record companies. And because the Grateful Dead is, you know, I never had to sign no contracts. We never have had contracts. It's always just been word of mouth agreement. You know, we agree on it, and that's that. You know, so
record by record.
Yeah. Record by record. There was never any like permanent situation. There never has been, and probably never will be. You know. And so I got sidetracked with that for a few years. In fact, right up until now, I'm still doing that. You know, but when I have free downtime in the Grateful Dead, like I could come out and do this band here. And I just got done producing a brand new Doug Song album, which, by the way, is a really great record. And yeah, in fact, in many ways, I think it's one of the nicest records he's ever done. You know, and so that was fun. We'll put that together, and then. Right after that, we pulled this together. We had this band out last May. We did a bunch of East Coast. We didn't get up here to D.C., but we did all around New York and New Jersey and upstate and whatnot, and colleges and stuff like that. And it was just one of those, hey, what the fuck, let's see what happens. You know, let's take a crack at it and see where it takes us. We went out and we did like a couple of weeks of just one right after another, bam, 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 hitting them, you know. And all of a sudden we dug it, we were really having a good time, and somehow there was like a bit of magic in the combination of this configuration of musicians. Was like one of those trips of where the whole is greater than the sum total of the parts trips, you know. And so we decided, well, hell, man, it felt that good, let's kind of keep kicking around and keep it in the back of our heads, you know. So then we got back into Grateful Dead, we did a bunch of that, and then last month that we finished up the new Grateful Dead album. We figured, well, fuck, we got some time to kill, you know. So let's throw this together and come out again, so we did it this time. The time before, we didn't have a bass player, and Keith was the bass player, and we didn't have a piano player, Keith was the bass player. But the music got like really involved and really started happening, and like so Keith moved back to his piano, and we got Michael Larsha, who was the bass player in the Keith and Donna band. If I don't know if you guys remember that.
Oh yeah, sure.
Okay. Well, Mike Larsha and Billy, of course, was the drummer in that band. Mike Larsha was the bass player in that band, and Mike was producing records in Milwaukee in a little studio he manages, and he manages the studio and produces records there. So we called him up. You know, Billy and I had actually, it was a funny way it happened. We actually really didn't call him. We were gonna call him. The last we heard, he was playing with a guy named Curly Cook, who is a great guitar player from Texas, one of the Texas bunch. He hung out and all the whole set of Texas musicians. And they were up in Seattle, Washington, playing this little go trip. And so that was the last we had heard of Larshai. And Carson and I were doing the Uptown Theater in the Grateful Dead here the last time we played here a few months ago. We were in Chicago, right? And so me and Billy were sitting in the room, and it was like getting towards the last few days of the tour. You know, we were talking about the Healy Tree Store, making plans and stuff like that. And so we were thinking, well, shit, how the fuck are we going to get a hold of Larshai? Because we knew we wanted to put Keith on the piano and get a bass player, because the group was rapidly expanding, and we wanted to keep up with the musical ideas and stuff that we were doing. So what we did was, we were talking about it, and we just began making plans for it, and we're sitting in Carson's hotel room in Chicago, and all of a sudden the fucking phone rings. And he picks it up, and it's Mike Larshai, of all people, from out of a clear blue sky. The last we had heard that he was in Seattle. Turns out that he had split up with Curly Cook, and he was in Milwaukee. And the studio that he has in Milwaukee has another annex studio in Chicago. And we happened to be down there talking to somebody who mentioned that he had seen Garcia. And Larshai says, oh yeah, where are they? He said, oh, those guys are in town, staying over at the hotel. So he calls us over there from out of nowhere. And we had just been sitting there saying, how are we going to get a hold of Larshai to play bass? Right? And the phone rings in, and here's this fucker is on the phone. We pretty shit, man. This is too deep. We can't pass this up. This is too deep.
So Facebook.
Yeah, so that settled it right there, then and there. That fixed that, you know. So the rest is like, the rest is we've been putting together, you know.
Yeah, I enjoyed it last time, you know. They gave me a lot of fun. They're going to beat you in the papers.
Pardon me?
They beat you in the papers. I hope you don't even read that shit.
What did they say? Who did you get what?
The papers. They were going to.
What did they say?
They just, you know, they put it down, you know. And I don't know why. I
was it that Sheriff Griner?
Yeah. Leah, something like that.
Harry. He came up here last night and interviewed me, and, you know.
No, it was a guy.
Okay. Some chick was here interviewing me. I thought it was a post, but maybe it was something else. Well, I mean, like, see, a weird things happen, like things that are completely out of your control. Like, for instance, some guy like that might be down on the street down there. For some reason, somebody neglects to let him in or something, so he gets an attitude and writes some shitty review or something. I mean, I don't know what the fuck.
We were there. We had
it's really hard to tell. I know what happened. I know we played good last night. I know it was great, you know.
It was.
So I don't know what the fuck. You know, I mean, if some people have some preconceived notion, particularly critics, and they sort of have this weird attitude of
the perfect point.
It's hard to say who or why people have attitudes or what they expect. Critics sometimes think they have to criticize. You know, I mean, it's like, it's an older school of journalism that's just narrow-minded in that respect, you know. It's like, who knows what the guy put in. I mean, I don't know. Maybe he didn't get a complimentary seat or something. I mean, Jesus Christ, you know, maybe the lady didn't fuck him that day. Or, you know, how do you know what makes some guy get bent about whatever, you know? I mean, certainly we didn't do anything weird. We played good last night, you know. I mean, I don't see how you can put that down. I mean, it was only what it was.
That's how the artist area is.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't really give a shit.
Yeah,
you know?
That's what I was just telling you. You should read the paper, not to get it, because this guy is typical for this guy to cut everybody.
Does he cut everybody?
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. He's like really hard line,
you know. But it's
I think he's an opera freak, you know. I mean, everything else is massive.
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, the thing is the guy is stupid because he shouldn't come and do this.
Exactly.
If he hates it that much, then why doesn't he assign it to somebody else? I mean, you know. Yeah, I mean, it sounds to me like there's a guy who don't enjoy his work. You know?
Yeah. Well, he just probably likes to see covering solid art events, you know.
Yeah, well, I don't know what the fuck he expected, you know.
Yeah, right.
It's so hard to tell about those things. You know, shit, there's nice, when I think that it's just puke shit awful, man. And I read the paper the next day and it's, God, these guys lay golden eggs, you know. So how do you know? It's so subjective.
I know. It's totally subjective.
It's totally subjective. I mean, shit, there's no legitimate way of ever knowing.
Hey, Harry Sunderall is the biggest cancel in the world.
Who's that?
A guy that wrote the review.
What's his name?
Harry Sunderall.
Oh, man.
Yeah, I don't know. Did he come and interview us or anything? Or did he just...
I don't know anything about the guy.
He probably just saw you.
We were the biggest local band here in D.C. for years, and he hated our band. And every time he reviewed us...
Well, Harry Sunderall, right.
Johnson Outlaw.
Yes?
Yeah, some of those guys just have a sick attitude like that, you know. It's, fuck, what can you say? I mean, shit, you gotta go to the
interview
going
on
here? Well, don't want to really.
Well, I just want to talk with a friend of mine, so this ain't.
Oh, okay.
Oh, sure.
I will be glad to, you know, sorry.
I'll take care of some business.
So what's it feel like, you know, playing guitar instead of like doing music, you know?
Well, it's largely the same.
I mean, you play all the time?
Oh, yeah, I've been playing since I was 14, 15 years old. I, you know, it's largely the same. You sort of have to do both to do one, you know. I mean, like, here's what happened. It's like, when I started learning how to mix and produce records and stuff like that, I got, like, past all of the sort of the academia part of it, you know, and I learned what everything did and what it was all about and everything, but I really didn't know enough about music, per se, to like, be able to really do what I felt was bridging the gap between taking a musical idea and actually being able to realize it on tape, or when you play it back, you can say, yeah, that's what I meant, you know, and so... At that point, along about 1967, 68, like I spent 2 years and I just stopped recording. I didn't even go in a studio. Me and Richard Treisis went out and hit the road.
We get in there
and we fucking play 7 days a week, play our ass, play, you know? And then, like, I would do a lot of things. Like, I played in the New Writers for a while. I was in that band. Yeah. For a while, and I played in little bands with Garcia and shit off and on over the years,
right.
And things like that. And, mostly I went on the trip of like getting my music, studying music, and getting that part of it together. You know, it's only been really, as far as I'm concerned, the last 4 or 5 years that I can really say that I feel like I know what I'm doing in the studio as far as being able to realize an idea. You know, I mean, it takes a lot to be able to have to conceive of an idea and then be able to actually put it into music, then get people to play it, then get to record it, get it on the tape and mix it down and have it even be somewhere even near what you thought you were gonna, you know. And I mean, man, I mean, I started out from like shit miles away from it, you know. But by keeping at it and just doing it and doing it and doing it, I began to learn, picking up the tricks of this and that and paying attention to other people. I watched a lot of musicians that I like and studied what their styles were.
When you
made
Steal Your Face,
yeah,
somebody told me that it was made on, what deck was that?
Steal Your Face was done on the Nagra.
It was?
Yeah.
Did you ever read books? They had a picture.
They do sometimes. They interview me sometimes and stuff.
They had a picture of talking to this machine.
And they said that Steal Your Face was recorded on it. And it had, okay.
First of all, you guys got to dig that the majority of all of that shit is bullshit.
That's what I thought. I thought it was
good.
I mean, why would I do that? Why would I do that? I mean, I have like the world's set up equipment.
That's why we talk to you.
It's bullshit, you know.
I mean,
it could be true. Maybe I did, you know, but no. Actually, it turns out, no, you know. It was recorded on an Agra, on a stereo Agra, which is what I do all my kids.
I bet you somebody got confused. You know. It's an Agra.
It sort of looks like that.
A little bit, right.
You know, people see that and they think, oh shit, a portable tape machine, huh? But I mean, you guys must, you know what an Agra
right,
is.
Right.
It's nothing like it. It's a definitive tape machine. And for like, hell, since the stereo Agra came out in like, I think, 69, and it's when we got the first one, and we mastered every record we've ever made is pretty mastered on the Nagras, because we like the sound of them. It's a good sounding machine, you know. And it's the only machine that has all-pass phase correction networks in it. Like, tape, the concept, the principle of the physics of tape recording has a lot of, like, phase distortions.
Right.
Just inherently the design of magnetizing metal, it creates a certain amount of phase shift. Well, Nagra is the only tape machine that has these networks in it that invests an equal and opposite amount of this phase shift so that it nullifies and everything comes out phase accurate. And that gives you a much more clear, transparent, better transient response.
Of course, less phase distortion.
Less phase distortion is obviously cleaner music. So that's what attracted me about the machine, you know.
Speaking of canceling circuits, did you have a problem? You use two microphones now.
We, at one time in the big system, had differential microphones. But differential microphones are actually, on paper they're great, but in reality they don't work. And the reason why is because in order to get a legitimate canceling, they got to be both omni, and they also both have to be real close together, because like at 4,000 cycles, the wavelength is only like 4 inches, you know? So like if they're less than that far apart, then it doesn't cancel anything above 4,000 cycles. So at some point it fails to cancel. So, but the thing is if you get them too close together and you can't sing, because when you sing, you got to sing into one of them only. Well, we had them about that far apart. We had them where they canceled up to about 4,000 cycles. They were B&K Laboratories instrument microphones. They're like the fine, you know what a B&K lab mic is.
Right.
They're the definitive.
Are they resin or
no? They're condenser.
But they got the power supply.
They have the power supply. There's like the circuit is in the body of the microphone, and it's fan power from the remote. Well, we bought a bunch of these and built them into these differential packs. They just come as mono microphones. And we built them into those little boxes and all of that. And then, but the problem with it is that in reality, when you're playing and singing, you can't stand perfectly still, and you can't address the microphone perfectly. I mean, there's a certain amount of movement, and the things were so accurate that if you move the least little bit, I mean, it would cancel your voice away. So it actually wound up being more of a pain in the ass. I mean, it was one of those things that was great on paper, but when you went to use it, like it just was impractical to try and use. So that's why we shit canned it, you know? I mean, it just was impossible to use it. That's not what we did instead is, like, later on, after that, I designed a thing that I call a vocal gate, which sort of does the same thing and goes about it in a different way. Do you know what a keypax is?
No.
Well, it's a gate. What it does is that it shuts off the microphone until above a certain threshold.
It's like a squelch, in a way.
Yeah, it's like a squelch, right, okay. Only, unfortunately, you can't use that on stage, because a lot of times you see ambience from the guitars and stuff, just as loud as your voice, and it'll trigger it open. So what I did is I devised a system that's a proximity sensor. It's a little thing that you attach to the microphone. And it works similar to, you know, like elevator buttons that you touch that don't have any moving force? It's, yeah, it's a capacitance system. Well, what this isn't exactly capacitance, this is an ultrasonic.
Really?
Yeah, ultrasonic transmitter and receiver. And it sends out a pulsed ultrasonic frequency, and it hits you and bounces back, and if it hits anything and bounces back within a certain distance, and you can set the distance, it turns on the microphone. So you step up to the microphone, and then I have the scrub circuit. I use an ADSR chip, which is an attack, decay, sustain, and release, which you find in synthesizers, which is an envelope generator. And I use that so that when you get up and it turns it on, you can regulate instead of it going back on, you can make it gently turn on, and then when you walk away from it, it turns off.
That's a great idea.
And that turned out to be far and away more efficient, because then you had you still had a regular microphone in terms of the response of that, but you also had the advantage of having it being off and not dumping a bunch of leakage ambience into the sound system when you're not using it. Because, I mean, you can manually switch them, but it's a pain in the ass, because you have to be on top of that, and if you're paying attention to that, then you're not paying attention to the overall, and distracts you from like, when I miss, like, I go on, like philosophically, the trip I go on in the Grateful Dead is to try and create a situation whereby you can sit in the audience and it's like being in front of the world's coolest stereo.
Right.
Hearing everything.
I feel like I'm sure, and
a great deal of the time I've actually managed to achieve it. It took me a lot of years, but it gets it.
Congratulations on the sound.
But in order to be able to do that, you really have to have your mind open to overall things, you know. So you can't be worrying about turning off and on someone's fucking microphone and stuff. So over the years I've created stuff like that just as a means to an end, you know. I mean, now a lot of people have, like, I've given away the circuit, and a lot of people are using it and stuff like that, but for me it was a means to an end, you know, just because I wanted something. I didn't dig the ambient leakage of all the microphones pretty much being on all the time. It washed out the mix and made it hard to get a good present sound. I didn't have the time or the desire to be fucking with the turning them off and on all the time, so the only alternative I had, since the differential microphones weren't practical, was to devise this gate trip, you know. And it worked really great. In fact, we're using it right now in the Grateful Dead. You know, I also there's a bunch of other stuff, like the Countryman piano pickup. I designed and built that when I was producing the Quicksilver Messenger Service when Nicky Hopkins was playing with us. Prior to that, like, they'd wrap a fucking rag around the microphone and stuff it down the sound hole, or put a frap or a contact mic on a piano. And I was out, and I produced Quicksilver, and after the record was done, the first one I did with them, there was this little promotional tour, so I agreed to go out and mix for them, just to kind of kick off their promotional tour. And it appalled me at this, here's this girl's incredible piano player, and this fucking area of garbage coming out of a contact mic on a piano, you know. So I was laying in bed one night, and I had this flash of designing a pickup.
A what?
A pickup, or a piano. And everybody had been using magnetics. At that time, I was also a member of Alembic, of which there was originally Owsley and Bob Matthews and myself and Ron Wickersham and Rick Turner. And those guys were at that time designing pickups and stuff. That's also in the days when we were starting to hop up guitars and invent our own pickups and shit like that. So those guys had their energy invested in magnetics. Magnetics, unfortunately, wouldn't work for the piano, at least in my mind, because of the extreme tension on the strings. The transient response like supersedes the ability of the magnets in a magnetic pickup, unless you had magnets that were so large you couldn't physically get them in the piano. So that's when I coughed up the capacitive system, which is limitless dynamic response and all of that kind of shit. So then I licensed Carl Countryman to make them. And also the phaser. Now everybody got phasers now, but it used to be if you wanted to do a phase, you'd have to make a duplicate copy of your tape. Then you start the two tape machines and you mix them both together, and as the two tapes start running by each other, it creates this phasing effect. Well, oftentimes to get the phase just where you want to in the songs and stuff, it'd take you all fucking day to get a track right. So like I said, well, why not build a phase shifter? So I started fucking around with this idea of building a phase shifter, and by that time I was already working with Carl Countryman about my piano pickup, so I got him to build me this phase shifter device, and that became the Countryman Phaser, which was also the first phasers ever. I mean, now MXR, every fucking buddy and their brother makes them, but at that point, Yeah.
That'd be amazing.
And also, like, there's the Direct Box. I've been in the Countryman Direct Box, too, which prior to that, everybody used shitty Transformers in a passive situation. And what happened was that if you do something like plug a bass guitar into it, it would load the pickup down enough that you'd lose all of the, like, sub frequencies. You'd lose everything from, like, 50 cycles down. And everybody in studios for years just did it and didn't say anything to anybody, you know. And the concept used to bug me because I was interested in getting full range sound. So what I did is I devised this box, which was an active box. And the significant difference is that it didn't tax the pickup, so that it didn't drag down the sound. Is there any chance I can get a little taste now? Okay. So what I wanted to do is I wanted to devise something that didn't tax the pickup. I wanted to be able to record a bass direct without fucking it up.
Right.
So what I did instead is I built a buffer, what's called a buffer, which is a stage of amplification. It doesn't necessarily amplify, but it separates. You know, so what it did is it placed an invisible load on the instrument while it converted it to a low impedance to go into the recording console. So it's an active thing.
Everybody's using transformers, you said.
Everybody prior to that was just using matching transformers,
right?
So what I did is I built this active one, and all it really was is a sophisticated FET buffer, FET buffer, and then it phantom powers, like, you know, condenser microphones phantom power, right? Well, this thing phantom powers too because it has active components in it, but the thing is that it offers like 50 meg impedance to the pickup instead of 50k, which transformers
were. Do you remember what year you started doing all this?
Oh, shit.
These FET keys have been out for a while. I mean, not in, you know, 7 years.
Well, low-level FETs have been around for probably 15, 20 years. Yeah. Right. See, the high-level power FETs are in
the current.
Yeah, power FETs are new. What it is it took them a long time to get a complimentary set of power FETs. In fact, nobody really still got a real rock-solid one, you know, but the Japanese guys are the world leaders right now in transistors. I mean, their rag transistors cut America's best transistors. There's no bullshit about that. I mean, there's just no comparison. I mean, their shitty transistors cut the best ones in America now. So, and they're coming out now. They got power FETs, not complimentary pairs and shit. They're fucking incredible devices. You know, 400-500 watt dissipation. They'll swing up to 1,000 volts and stuff like that. Super quiet. Infinitely high input impedance and infinitely low output impedance. I mean, the ideal fucking on the low level still offer the same thing. Even low power FETs still give you the advantage of infinitely high impedance input and infinitely low output. So it makes it like a really hip device for doing things like converting a guitar pickup to a recorded board and stuff like that. It's the perfect buffer, you know, and they're low noise, and you can get them to match up pretty good and track pretty good, so you can buy some up, and then they can go through temperature changes and pretty much hang together.
You have to do a little bit, but
because it's not a high power situation, you don't really have to worry about it that much. And I just designed my stuff to swing four times what it needs to swing. That way, if the bias shifts around a little bit, you're still out within the window of the swing you want. So it doesn't matter, you know. And so, like, I guess, can I get a rum and coke? So, like, I guess I started doing, 1969 is when I, 70 is when I invented the phaser in the direct box, and 71 I did the pickup, the piano pickup, because that's when I was producing the Shady Grove album, Quicksilver, Messenger Service, and I subsequently did some more after that, but that was the first one there, so I produced. And like I said, that pickup was a means to an end, because I was sick and tired of hearing Nicky Hopkins plays with a fucking contact mic, you know. And then Nicky quit the group, and then I that was when I was out roaming around. Then I came back to the Great Blade. I was with the Great Blade before that, and then I kind of, what I wanted to do is I just wanted to go out and sort of expand my scope a little bit. So I just went to the band and all the Grateful Dead guys and said, look, you guys, I need a year or two sabbatical. I want to go out and learn some more things. I'll be more valuable to you when I come back. You know, I needed to experience more stuff. So then I went out and I did those Quicksilver records and I developed that pickup and stuff. And then just about that time I came back to the Grateful Dead, Keith joined. And so that gave us another piano, and it gave me another opportunity to have somebody who was willing to stretch out with me, try ideas and stuff. So then I took that pickup to the second step, which is where it is now, which is like a real polished version of it. And it's still to this day. Like, after that, Help and Steel guys came out with a magnetic one, but it sells for a lot less money, but it's a real kind of a cheesy thing, you know? It's a piece of shit, kind of.
Have you seen their suitcase? They have a whole little...
Yeah, they were routine. don't sound very...
It doesn't sound good. They use real thin magnets, and the tension is so great on the piano that it just saturates the shit out of the magnets. So if you get on it a little bit, it just starts turning to garbage. But that's why I selected the electrostatic system. The Countryman pickup works like a condenser microphone works. Only instead of there being a diaphragm, the strings are the diaphragm. So the plates, there's little plates that lay down across the top of the strings, and they're polarized with a polarizing voltage and also connected to the input of a 3-amp. And then the strings are grounded, and then the strings moving within that field generates the voltage, and that's how it works. But the unique thing about it is that it's limitless in swing. You can get all the swing you want out of it and stuff, you know. And you don't have to worry about saturation and things like that. I mean, it can deal with the realistic dynamics of a piano, which are like some 10 times greater than a guitar or even a drum. The piano has the most tension of any instrument, any acoustical instrument. Like the tension on the string, when you strike it, there's more energy exchanges place in a piano than in any other instrument. And I mean, like if you go to measure it, you'll damn soon see that. Pianos have an incredible transient response, you know, and that was another thing about it. I mean, shit, when you contact Michael's soundboard, I mean, that's just so limited in what you get out of it. You don't hear it half the sound, and what you do hear is all saturated and distorted and crap like that, you know. So there just had to be. So I was, like, fucking somewhere on the road one night, you know, and I just woke up out of this sleep, and I'm like, my God, that's how to do it, you know, and I flashed on trying this capacitor system. Because, like, I was participating in a Lemmy at that time, and Owsley and Wickstrom, those guys are going, oh, you got to use magnets, you got to use magnetics, because they were into magnetics. But I couldn't conceive of getting a magnetic setup that was small enough to be fitting into pianos and still be able to not saturate and stuff like that. I mean, I tried it, and you just couldn't do it, you know. The helmet still saturates. I mean, if you don't care, great, you know, it's a great $500 pickup. But if you do care, it doesn't work.
Were you around with Ben when Alice gave Ben that sound system that was a really strange sound system?
It never kind of worked.
Well, that was actually no.
Did he know what he was doing, or what?
I don't know. Yeah, I'm sure he did. I'm sure he had some idea in mind. I mean, Owsley's a very brilliant guy, you know. You have to remember, in those days, there really wasn't very much stuff to choose from. I mean, like a 40-watt amplifier in those days was considered a killer amplifier, you know. I mean, shit, we joke about shit like that now, but that was considered a real significant amplifier in those days. So there really wasn't a lot to choose from, and speakers likewise. So the Bear had all this Altec stuff hooked up for the band. But Owsley's concept was this trip of, like, everybody playing through one amplifier, that kind of trip. But in reality, it's like the differential microphones, and you got to do it. It's really not that good of an idea. It doesn't work. There are too many things that come into play that you don't initially flash on, but that are actually... For one of the things, this intermodulation distortion is a big problem, just to say. So I think that the main reason why that idea didn't work for the Bear was the concept of trying to mix everything all together into one system, you know. It seemed like it wanted to... Thanks.
We got a point raised today that Bear... disconnected half of the differential microphone in front of the entire PA. You know, it was stacked up.
But the Bear's notorious for doing shit like that.
This was the most mind-boggling, insane sound.
You might say it was an enlightening experience.
Yeah, everybody dove kind of in a state of panic, shocked, silently, headed for the doors. You know,
that system was 57,000 watts. RMS, too. RMS.
There's a microphone in front of the wall.
Owsley did that, but he's done a couple of those to me. One time, like in the Rolling Stone, the movie, the Altamont movie, you know, we did that Altamont gig, and we also, the day before that, we had a gig at Winterland, which is the great event in the Rolling Stones. And I had set up a sound system, and Owsley's one of those guys that's famous for coming in at the last minute wanting to change something, right, you know, so... In those days, this was when solid-state amps were brand new, and we had these Crown DC-300s, which was like the first transistor high-power amp, you know, although there was a hell of a lot of things wrong with them that they later had to revise. But one of the things was that they would latch up and set your speakers on fire and shit like that. So, because they weren't protected, and that was before the days of learning how to take care of thermal runaway and all that, and current protection, current limiting and stuff like that. So, I had set up this whole entire sound system, And I was trying, on all my bass cabinets, I was using these new Crown DC-300s, and at that time they were brand new. So it's about 10 minutes before showtime, right, and Rolling Stones are ready to go on. Alza comes in late as usual. Hey, I want to hook up my cassette machine. So, okay, great. So he walks up to the booth, and he pulls this typical Alza, he pulls the wire loose, and it's like it was an RCA plug. Well, you know how you pull out an RCA plug, and the ground comes loose before the center comes loose, so for that moment, you're putting some potential in the system. Well, he leaves the fucking pot wide open, he goes and pulls this thing out, runs all these fucking Crowns to full power, they all latch up, and all of my fucking speaker cabinets catch on fire and start burning, man. And this is like 5 minutes before the show starts, man. Owsley, man. So like the booth is up, this is in Winterland, and the booth is up on the second balcony, and I started running after him because I was going to beat him up, and I was fucking pissed off for him burning up my whole goddamn system before the show started. And so I started going up the stairs one way, and he runs the other fucking way. I get up there, his cassette machine is up there, and I grab it, and I throw it down, and he bounce it off his back, and I'm, get the fuck out of here, I'm going to kill you, man. And then I proceed to get all the Grateful Dead crew guys, and we feverishly rip down all the fucking bass cabinets, take out all the speakers, and make this incredible run over to Oakland to Leo's Music and buy all these new speakers, and the show is great. Oh, God, man. That's the bear story. That's like typically the bear. But I mean, for all of that weirdness, he's a very brilliant guy, man. A very brilliant guy. And he's come up with some incredible innovations, man. He's been one of the major contributors to the state of the art, you know. Right now, we unveiled a sound system New Year's at the Oakland Auditorium when we played there. That's definitely the sound system of the future. It incorporates computers and stuff, and we've got it down now where we've got computers that continuously, real-time, sense every speaker in the system, determine whether or not it's operating in a linear fashion and linearizing so that, and at the same time, all of the speakers all get swept out for time delay so that they're all adjusted so that the arrival time is all exactly the same. The frequency response is all automatic, so now we've got it down so where you just set up the sound system, you hit the enable button, it completely time aligns all your system, then it equalizes it all, and then it completely goes through and evens it all out, you know, all completely automatic. And it sounds like nothing you ever heard before. I mean, for one thing, it's one of the big problems you run into is when you stack up a sound system, just because of the physical limitation of different speakers, the bass speakers and the high-frequency speakers and stuff aren't exactly the same physically. So as in order to stack them up in a stack, you'll have some speakers will be farther forward than other ones. What that gives you is that gives you different arrival times because sound travel is reasonably slow. And if you got a speaker, two speakers there, one is a foot closer than the other one, then the sound's going to get you from one of them before the other one. Then the net result is that you're going to hear two things.
Right.
Well, now, if you take and blow that up times 500 speakers in a sound system, you get one hell of a lot of echo.
You put it in a small place?
It doesn't matter whether you put it in a big place or a small place. So what the main benefit of time aligning all of the speakers is that it takes away all of this echo. And it'll make a room that just sounds like a garbagey echo pit sound reasonably present because you're not dealing with 500 different arrival times. You've only got one arrival time. And the coherency is just amazing. You know, and if you take that coupled with this, the other facet of the system, which is a series of what's called all pass networks, which is a type of tone network. The difference between all pass networks and high and low and band pass networks is an all pass network alters the phase but doesn't alter the amplitude. Whereas like regular, like a high pass filter or low pass or like a tone control, alters the amplitude of the highs or the lows or the mids. An all pass network only alters the phase of it, but it doesn't alter the amplitude. So that doesn't sound any different, but it will delay it or advance it and stuff like that. So by having a considerable series of these all-pass networks linked up to the computer, then what it does is you put sample mics out in the room, and it puts bursts of sounds out through each one of the speakers, and it measures the time, and it advances or delays each speaker accordingly, to where when it's finished, that you get one uniform coherent wavefront. And I mean, the difference is just night and day. It's not like anything you've ever heard before.
Right, that's all.
I mean, it's gonna make all sound systems obsolete. I mean, it's like, it's so incredibly different than
especially
anything
you've ever... Especially the concert hall, where it's so
microphone. Oh, it's the answer, man. And the other thing it does is that it gives you a lot more efficiency, because you don't have to... Because we're getting 50% to 60% more percent efficiency out of the same amount of stuff, so instead of having two truckloads of stuff to do Madison Square Garden, you only need one truckload. Which is really important these days and age, with fucking gas and transportation and labor and stuff like that, just skyrocketing to the point where people can't even function anymore. I mean, every little savings like that, I mean, cutting off an hour a day in the Grateful Dead setup means $50,000 at the end of the tour. You know, in union costs and stuff like that. So, like, all of that shit is real important right now, you know. So this is a crucial time for developments like that to come about, you know. So that's, like, what's going on right now, and that's, like, the sort of the, that's the real state of the art. But it's so new that there's really only, like, that R1, our prototype breadboard system. But we used it New Year's, and it was, like, it was incredibly more successful even than we thought. I mean, it was, like, nothing you ever heard before. I mean, shit, you could sit in the back of the auditorium and it's just like you're sitting in your living room in front of a bitchin' pair of speakers. I mean, it fucking blew my mind. I couldn't believe it.
So,
I mean, I could mix things. I could get into levels of mixing that I've only dreamt about in the past. I mean, you know, levels of fine mix. You know, like layers of things that I've always wanted to be able to do in during concerts and stuff that I can now do. I mean, man, I can make like 1 dB changes in tone and things and hear it. You know, where it used to be like typically in a system you can make a 5 or 6 dB change in sound and not even fucking know the difference in all the din of the echo. You know? So I mean, man, that's the magnitude of how different this is. Okay, Smig.
So this is the system that I have.
So that's going to be the trip, yeah. So the next thing right now is what we're doing is we're going to try and license some people to build it for us. The Grateful Dead, it's not practical for us to own our own sound system anymore. In 1974, when we built that big system, it was really great, but it pretty much ate us alive, doubled in prices and all of that. And like, it got to not be fun anymore. I mean, the Grateful Dead wasn't fun for us anymore. We were working so hard.
You grind hard, you know? You guys were always in the
red. We just got burnt out, you know? So we decided to... We didn't really break up. We just said, look it, man, for the time being, let's just shelve everything and think about this for a while, you know? First of all, let's just all take 6 months and go cool out, you know? And what we never really did is not hang out together or break up. I mean, we don't know. Actually, all during that time, what we did is we made the Grateful Dead movie. That's what we were doing during that time. So we were... And so, like, we were actually active, we just didn't go out and tour. And then after about a year or so, we finally all got so fucking horny to play, we decided, shit, man, let's go back at it again. But this time we did it in a much lower profile, and we decided that it's not feasible in this day and age, with the economy being what it is, for us to try and also own our own sound system. In other words, we'll be doing good to just play our music, show up, and keep that together, you know. So, and let the people that are in the business full time of sound systems do the sound system, you know. So, like, I've been using, like, well, west of the Rockies, I have been using Northwest Sound, but now I'm using our own new little trip. And east of the Rockies, I use the Clare Brothers, who have built me a special portion of their system to the Grateful Dead standards and stuff like that. But this new system is even going to make that. I mean, the Clare Brothers is probably the finest PA going today.
Right.
As far as a rental PA. It's head and shoulders above anybody else on all levels. But this new chip that we got going is even going to make that obsolete. In fact, the Clare Brothers are already, like, wondering about it, because anybody that knows anything about sound, when you see and hear that, you know right away that that's where it's at. You know? I mean, there's no way around it. You cannot. It's an undeniable, you know, I mean, it's so blatantly cool that you just fucking can't deny it. So,
makes it worth
after time. You hear that, you don't even want to listen to anything else. It makes everything else sound like shit, you know.
Yeah.
So, like, I'm just into wanting to see that get on, you know. That's what I've been doing in the Grateful Dead. And the other thing is that the Grateful Dead has never really, in my opinion, done a really killer live album. So what I've been doing about over the last 2 years is I've been developing a way to record the Grateful Dead live that uses what I call clusters of microphones in an MS situation, which is a sum and difference kind of a setup. So we use microphones where you put them back to back, and where the patterns overlap, they add and subtract in certain ways. It's how your ears are thought to work, you know, the way you can tell if something, the sound is coming from there or there, something like that. It's three per cluster. There's usually you have two like this.
Yeah.
If the stage is that way, you have two like this and then one that way. All right, then by processing it through a summing network, a summing and differentiating network, it separates it up so when you hear it back, like you can, it has two things. It has one, it has the coherent point of view. In other words, if you take two stereo mics and you put them far apart, in reality, your ears aren't far apart.
Right.
So while it gives you separation and stuff like that, it lacks a certain amount of authenticity because it's hearing it from this distance.
Right.
But the other way of looking at it is put the microphones here and let it listen from out there like your ears work. Now that's my own, that's after going through, having tried all the different ways, that's the way that I personally like the most and the way that I feel is the most realistic. So I developed this AMS system. I mean, it's not a new invention. I mean, Christ, it was in like the first, I read about it in a journal that was like published in 1941.
Right, I think you just use transformers.
Yeah, you use the transformer chip, you know. I mean, it's
but
like
you can use it now because it's a transformer.
Well, I use a solid state equivalent version, you know, but it was, that was the trip, use the transformer, the multiple point. I'm sure you've seen schematic stuff and stuff like that. So what I do is I take that and then I hang clusters like one near the stage and one farther out, 20 or 30 feet more out, and then one 20, 30, 40 feet farther out. Then I take and then I also mic the band. Then I take and I electrically delay the band after the first cluster, and then that one after the second one after the third one. And that result is that the sound that you hear, two things happen. Number one, it's like you're on the stage and in the audience and everywhere all at the same time. So you hear it like
you are going to need some help besides this. We're having a little trouble with the set because they want to do like only eight songs for you. I can't get into the goddamn thing when it's just that short.
I can't. Why is their attitude that way?
It's the club owner or someone else. Gary's telling me.
Okay.
Everybody's got to go to work.
Oh, it is cool.
Anyway, it creates a hologram, too. The other thing that happens is that the sound, if you have a pair of speakers, like, you can do this, and the sound appears out here in the room, and you can walk around and you can stand between the speakers and the sound sounds like there, even though the speakers are behind it. It's like in a hologram, an acoustical hologram, and it really works. And that's like the method that I'm perfecting and unveiling for the recording of the next Grateful Dead Live album. Then what I intend to do is I intend to get the band to book a tour of solely for the purpose of recording of all the choice halls around the country, you know. So do it like 10 different venues, our 10 most favorite venues.
What are some of your favorite places?
Shade. I like the Uptown Theater. I like the Fox in Atlanta. I like, there's a little place, the Soldiers and Sailors Memorial in Kansas City.
Stanley
Theater's cool. Yeah, mostly those kind of places. You know, that gives you the idea. That's roughly the trip. What I want to do is I want to plan a tour in those places and then take this setup and record the whole tour. Then you just go back home, check out all the good shit, and then theoretically we should have a real great album.
When are we going to see you guys again on the East Coast? When are they going
to
be touring?
We're going to do a Saturday Night Live the first week of next month. And also a Nassau County Coliseum and a Deadhead show at the Capitol Theater, which we may also broadcast.
Are you going to do that for
It was a question. At the Madison Garden last spring, they turned their lights on and started set on the crowd.
It's the third one.
Why did they do so fucking funny?
Cool the
you guys can have to play.
Yeah, all right. Cool out the audience.
Yeah.
Because we got a phone call that says that's not
one
of the band members. Really? They had the lights on and had a bunch of plainclothes guys.
It was a great show, though.
I know. Come on in. I embarrassed
him
last night. Who's fighter in English?
Yeah,
sure.
He did.
I'll tell you.
Great.
Man has his shit.
I had a fine time.
What's the
You were well last night, though.
Yeah, well, but that's because I can hear the most. When I hear what I'm doing, it's great. I just wear on and on. I can sing forever when I hear what I'm doing. If I don't hear what I'm doing, it's different. So yes, I am. Mistrovich.
That'll frost your nuts, man.
They all live on the side of the bay. You see, I come from over in which is on this side.
I did too, but what happened was
you were nice. That's okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Really, man, it's like, we just wanted to talk to some people here for a little while. It was, you know, for sure.
These guys
They're
all great. They're all
good musicians.
You
don't know, actually.
They're all fun.
So,
what
are you
going to
do for
Well, I'm going to Memphis. I'm going to
You said you rehearsed behind the movie theater on Front Street. Remember the one thing? I asked you how you like to shake down street.
We were waiting for a train
last week, and we were going to go to the council.
Do they give you a lot of shit though? Do you go right in the past? There's a lot of people out here that are, really responsive to that. I feel like
After a while, you don't worry about it. You just warm up to it. Because they probably make it feel
good. Oh, they do. The
audience
is
going to be the audience. It's just you. If you really enjoy yourself, they're going to follow you.
Yeah, that's true.
Because that's how I felt last time. Like everybody. I came in, I went into this place and I had really good.
I was just kind of like, well, I don't know what to expect. I was really surprised. I'm sitting there, just plugging in my CD, I get up, I'm like, what is this? I've done lots of tapes and lots of things with different bands, but never mind these guys.
Don't get too glued up.
Yeah.
Scream and yell at him a little bit.